Well, we have just finished a summer season of plumbing the depths of Jesus' parables. We have reimagined a world where God works with humans to create new ways of being in the world. Today, I want to add my concluding thoughts to this, but also point us towards our upcoming work for this fall with the book, The Reenchantment of Everyday Life by Thomas More. I love parables. I love them because they're pithy and they're often very mysterious at heart. Remember the parable of the empty jar a few weeks ago? And by the way, one of my favorite memories of that morning, the morning I gave that sermon on the empty jar parable, was how many of you came up to me afterwards with your interpretations of Jesus' teaching. I love it when we do theology together. Now, speaking of parables, there is a great parable in the Talmud. The Talmud is the ancient book of Jewish law, and this parable goes like this. Someone asked the teacher, "What if one person missed the mark? What if one person sins? What happens to the community?" And the teacher answered thusly, "It's like a company of people on board a ship, and one of them took a drill and began to bore a hole under himself. And the other passengers said to him, 'What are you doing?' And he replied, 'Well, what has this to do with you? Am I not making a hole under my seat?' And they replied, 'But the water will enter and drown us all.'" Abraham Cohen, who translated the version of the Talmud I'm using this morning, he continues to remind us of this important fact. People are not intended to live alone, but as members of communities, as members of society. We are a unit in the body of humanity. And that fact creates many duties for us, with our respect, in relationship with other people. Our life is not our own to do with as we please. Our conduct affects our neighbors, as their conduct affects us. Our actions have consequences. Drilling a hole in a boat under your seat, not just for us, but for those around us. Now, obviously, this parable is in the extreme. They often are. But it speaks to something very important that we encounter when living in community together, and that is, where is the line between your freedom to live as you wish and my safety and security? Does your right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, whatever that may be to you, trump my right to the same? I think this is the core question of our lives together, and I think we have a number of ways that we can approach this conundrum. I'm going to use some very broad strokes this morning as we attempt to find a way to live in community without destroying each other. So let's go way back in time. Come with me to the earliest words that we have in the Hebrew Bible, and let's see what those ancient stories had to say about creation and how the world that we co-create with God requires us to consider our neighbors in every single act of creation that we participate in, positive, neutral, and negative. Where do y'all think the idea of sin comes from? Most people, when asked what the first sin in the Bible is, will tell me, "Well, it's the fall of man. It's Adam and Eve's disobedience to God." But that's not in the Hebrew Bible. It doesn't say that. It doesn't use the word sin. And the word for sin in Hebrew is called hamartia. And it's from archery. And it means to miss the mark, to miss the target. And the Hebrew Bible doesn't use the word sin until chapter 4. Of Genesis, when Cain and Abel had brought their gifts of offering to Adonai, and Adonai preferred Abel's offering to Cain's offering. Now, both boys brought their very best to offer in gratitude to God, and in this instance, God preferred Abel's over Cain's. And Cain did little to hide his disappointment from God. For Genesis chapter 4 says these words, "Then the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it.'" Sin, the missing of the mark, is right there, ready and waiting to be part of your creation, but we must rule over it. So in the act of creating an offering to God, Cain was more concerned with besting his brother than he was with considering what he had created. And because of that, his creation, his offering, missed the mark. Now, was Cain's sin in this case jealousy? I mean, he was envious that in this instance, his offering to God was not as well liked as Abel's offering to God. So perhaps, but I think the bad seed that was lying in wait, crouching by the door, I think it was discontent. Cain was not content with what he had created, and therefore, when God preferred Abel's offering over his, it was a very short step to jealousy and anger, and we all know what happens next. It leads to violence, murder, Abel's death by his brother's hands. To me, the point of this story is that we need to be very careful in whatever we are creating, because if we're creating something negative in the world, it will have negative consequences. And God will be right beside us, co-creating along with us. Be careful what you co-create with God, because God is going to go along with it. It is creation. It's going to go out in the world, and it'll interact with others, whether it's a painting or a poem, a family, a new career, an article for the church's newsletter, or just a craft or a project that you've been working on. You have made something that wasn't there before, and you set it onto a course out into the world. Now, no one can say what reactions will occur as your creation careens about the universe. I mean, it might just sit there on the shelf and not interfere with anything. But when you've co-created something with God and you've done it for the right reasons, then your creation has a much better chance of impacting the world in a positive, useful way. Creation. This is something that we do with God. Okay, so now what? Now we've created something, hopefully something positive, and we've put it out there in the world, but how to maintain it? How do we sustain it? So I know this guy, he's a farmer, and he works really, really hard. He also sits on his town's city committee, working side by side with others in his community to assure that everyone gets what they need to have happy, healthy lives. His day often begins at sunrise, and he's out in his fields, and he never knows when his cell phone's going to ring, and he'll have to head off to the community building to help with some pressing issue. I hope you have in mind one of Kansas's multitudes of farmers who have tractors and combines and all manner of help to assist them in their sacred task of caring for their crops and their livestock. But the gentleman I'm talking about is named Juan Enrique, and he is the chairman of the Comité of Chakra Seca, Nicaragua. And when I said he was out in his fields tending his crops, he is literally on foot with a machete chopping yucca to be collected later that day and sold in nearby León. Some of us were so fortunate enough that we got to spend some time with him out in one of his dusty fields as he very proudly showed us what he spends his days doing. And he showed us that cell phone that will ring at any time and require him to find a way to the Peace House, which is almost 10 miles from his farm. Yes, Juan Enrique lives on the farthest edge of the community of Chakra Seca. Now, sometimes he can get a ride with someone in their pickup or on a motorcycle, but more often than not, he has to walk all the way to the Peace House and then home again after he's put out whatever fire they called him about. Oh, and one other thing. Juan Enrique is tasked with caring for the community's water supply. Yeah, not only does he work in his fields from sunup to sundown and serve as the de facto leader of his community of 9,000 souls, he's also responsible for ensuring that the pumps that pull up the barely potable water remain in service. The day after we'd seen him in his fields, ask Pam about this, she was with us that day. The day after we'd seen him in his fields, we got to spend some time with him at the pumping station. And he was showing us and telling us about the difficulties in maintaining Chacraseca's water system. So you see, 10 years ago, the community did not have centralized water. But a company from Europe sponsored them and helped them build this water system that guaranteed each household would have a pipe of water running to it. It's a complex system, and it is very difficult to maintain, but Juan Enrique does it, as he told us, because if he didn't, who would? And it's important to him to sleep each night knowing that his community has water running to their houses. Never mind that in the time since the wells were dug, the highly volcanic nature of the surrounding landscape has caused this water to become brackish and not drinkable. You can use it for household needs, cleaning, some watering, but it tastes and smells so foul that you could never drink it. So the residents still must figure out each couple of days how to get their drinking water barrels to a nearby tank of potable water and then get it home again. And Juan Enrique oversees that task as well. Those of us lucky enough to know this man were amazed at his capacity for sustaining his community. He works tirelessly to do all those tasks that keep this community in water, both fresh and not so fresh, and he works as their mayor, and he tends to his own fields. Juan Enrique sustains all of this because he has a deep and abiding faith, not only in his own abilities, but he has a deep and abiding faith in God. And he told us it was this faith that gives him the strength to do those things that need to be done each day to ensure that his people not just survive, but thrive. I sincerely hope some of you will consider going with us this coming January when we will again travel to Nicaragua and continue to sustain our growing relationship with this community that has so much to teach us. I mean, it's got lots to teach me, especially about how we sustain our lives in conjunction with the God of creation. Okay, so we've got a creation, and we've figured out a way to sustain it, how to keep it going. But what about when the time comes to realize that it, whatever it is, can no longer be sustained? Inevitably, everything ends. Careers, relationships, families, our very lives. It is the way of the world. Everything eventually comes to an end. Even great works of art will one day end. But what can we do to reclaim something, a piece of what has ended? How do we take the good, loving, life-filled parts of something that has ended and turn it into something else? Recycle. Reuse, reclaim. Even Juan Enrique realizes that they will soon have to dig new wells farther from the volcanoes, and they'll reclaim some of the pipes and equipment from their current system, turn it into something new. The Bible has lots to tell us about the ends of things. And I'll admit, I have great difficulty in accepting some endings. Because for good or for bad, I'm an eternal optimist. And I always think I can use my energy and my creativity to figure out how to save something, how to salvage a relationship or a piece of art or a project. Because I personally have great trouble with the finality of endings. But sometimes there is wisdom in ending something. Sometimes things must die. In 66 CE, 66 of the Common Era, the Jewish population that was living in Jerusalem and the Middle East, that population was bubbling with fervent energy and the whispers of result. It was but a few decades since the brutal crucifixion of Jesus. And the Jewish followers of the new Jesus movement were gaining adherents and pushing against not only the Roman occupiers, but the traditional Jewish authorities who felt that this new offshoot of Judaism was heretical. It was a tense time in Palestine. It seems it's always a tense time in Palestine. Anyway, in 66 CE, a war began outright. The Great Revolt, as it's called, had its genesis in many possible places, but I'm convinced that this is what happened. The occupying Romans had determined that the Jewish population of Jerusalem had not paid their fair share of taxes. And because of this, the Romans then increased the persecution of the Jews. And the Romans also knew there was plenty of money inside the Great Temple. So eventually, the Roman governor, Decius Florus, responded by raiding the temple. And as you can imagine, this fanned the flames of revolt, and for the next year, there was a massive war within and around Jerusalem. Eventually, there was a lull on both sides in these military operations, and by 69-70 CE, things had settled into a semi-permanent ceasefire. But it was during this calm that had the Roman generals maneuvering to end the political blockade that had to this point prevented an all-out total attack on Jerusalem. In January of 70 CE, the military might of the Roman Empire descended on Jerusalem from the north and laid siege for 7 months. Finally, in the summer of the year 70 CE, the Romans, who had so weakened the city's defenses and the infighting among the Jewish authorities, the Pharisees and the Zealots, had so weakened the city's resolve, these two combined, and the city fell to the Romans. And then they sacked and looted Jerusalem. They took special care to ensure the near complete destruction of the Jewish temple. I have chosen this problematic illustration of the destruction of the Second Temple to align with my discussion on the reclamation of things to show a point. Christianity would probably have never been able to take such a strong foothold in the world without this cataclysmic event. The Gospels were written shortly after the destruction of the temple, and we see an immediate upswing in the number of followers in this new form of Judaism. I call this problematic because it took the terrible suffering of one faith, Judaism, to open a path for another one, Christianity, to blossom. This is but one way at looking at what happened in the early days of Christianity, but I use it to illustrate what reclaiming with God might accomplish, regardless of the intentions of those early leaders. I always wonder, is there a third way? Is there a way beyond the end of things? I don't know. And this is one of the great mysteries that keeps me coming back to this place week after week, hoping to find some insight into this great contradiction, the contradiction of the necessity of endings and the possibility of beginnings, and the sacred tension that exists between these two. One final option that we need to look at in this co-creating act with God is recreation, or recreation, that regular realization that not only do we create and sustain and reclaim, but we also must recreate with God. There's a quote by the novelist Sue Monk Kidd, and it's in your bulletins. And it reminds us of something very important about this act of reclaiming in these words. Here's Sue Monk Kidd's words. Here is where our real selfhood is rooted. in the divine spark or seed, in the image of God imprinted on the human soul. The true self is not our creation, but God's. It is the self we are in our depths. It is our capacity for divinity and transcendence. So for me, Sunday mornings are all about recreation. We gather together. We talk and plan and dream. We sing. We listen. We learn. We love. I gather great energy and strength for the coming week from this place, these people, and this time together. I hope we all do. For the past 22 years, I have been getting my weekly dose of recreation in this place, and I hope to do so for the next 22, God willing. Because it is here where my God spark deep within me gets rekindled just a bit. I get recharged and refocused and ready for the coming week. To me, this is what we do with God. We create, we sustain, we reclaim, and then we recreate. We're always somewhere in this great wheel, this great cycle of life. And I believe that when we realize this about our connection with God, then the ability to recreate with God becomes that much more urgent, that much more necessary, and in my experience, that much more effortless. We relax into our connection with the divine, and we recognize that spark within all of us, each one of us, the spark of creation that is always there, always ready to be rekindled into that flame of life that is our inner light. It never goes out. In fact, even when I speak of endings, I believe that when we die, whatever that spark is deep within us, that spark never dies. It never ends. I believe it is that spark that returns to God. That's where it came from long ago. We come from God, and I believe upon our deaths, we return to God. What a powerful image to keep before of us as we turn the daily wheels of our lives through this cycle of creation, sustainment, reclamation, and recreation. The God spark that is our souls, yearning to burn bright and to show the world what living in love and in a loving community is all about. Let your spark shine so bright that others are drawn to it, to you, to your warmth, to your brilliance, to your love. May your light burn ever so bright for as long as you may keep it kindled. Amen.